You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, May 4th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. We are jam-packed today, folks, on the program. First up, Aaron Kleinman, Director of Research at Future Now, on the looming specter that will be redistricting. Then, Astra Taylor and Ume Hoke, organizers with the Debt Collective and a student debt striker, on the progress or lack thereof, the issue of student debt. Meanwhile, speaking of the progress on student debt, Joe Biden now pressured to loosen the patent protections on vaccines the world desperately needs, and that pressure is growing. With good reason, India passes 20 million COVID cases as fears of a new variant grow. In the U.S., the FDA is expected to approve Pfizer for children as young as 12. House Republicans to move to oust Liz Cheney from leadership, and okay, Joe Biden reverses on refugee admissions, reinstates the 62,500 cap for this fiscal year, and promises 125,000 for the next fiscal year. How about a proposal to just double both those numbers and then actually get rid of the cap? Meanwhile, U.S. starts to reunite separated families on U.S. soil, immigrant families, I should say, as part of an agreement with the ACLU. Speaking of various letters, MDMA is closer to medical approval as it is found to help with PTSD in conjunction with talk therapy.
PTSD.
PTSD.
There you go.
Sorry. Kansas Republicans failed to overturn a Democratic governor veto on ban of trans girls and women athletes. EPA proposes a rule to slash hydrofluorocarbons, which is a major source of greenhouse gas. All this and more on today's Majority Report, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for joining us. Ooh, there we go. It is Tuesday. And as we wind our way through the week, joining me as always, Emma Vigeland. Emma, hello. How are you?
I am well. How are you?
I am fine. I am fine.
Gotta come up with a new intro there. We're always good.
It's true. There's no real suspense there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's or maybe it's just encouraging for people.
Right. Well, I mean, I think things are looking up.
Okay.
With the vaccine.
Well,
and COVID.
There's more vaccine
outside, at least in the United States.
We're moving. Yes, absolutely. And we're moving into a new phase, obviously. And we've been talking about this for a couple of days of or I should say really a couple of weeks. New phase of attempting to vaccinate people. There is more and more stories about how to vaccinate the reluctant vaxxers and the right wing, you know, die hard. I'm not going to get vaccinated just to prove that I'm going to own the libs, as it were. And in my estimation, that's a bit of a mistake. There are millions of people in this country who would be willing to be vaccinated if the vaccines found them and became more convenient. People obviously have work and childcare obligations and don't necessarily have the means to travel in the same way. And so what the government, I think, needs to do is start to get a little better at that and give the vaccine reluctance a little more time, maybe get it to primary care physicians who might have a better relationship with them. But that is just what we need to do in this country. Right now in India, there is the outbreak is horrible. And there are obviously new variants that are growing. Some reports of a variant that is even more contagious than the B117 that I believe is over there as well. And it is hitting younger people. And one of the things that we need to do, and there's a lot of talk as to whether we can actually achieve herd immunity in any real way, never mind just in this country, but just broadly speaking around the globe. The bottom line is we need to get the vaccine deployed to more people. And the experts who do not have any vested interest in the IP, the intellectual, the so-called intellectual property, one way or another, unanimously say that loosening the patent restrictions on this, on these vaccines, and not just the formalization of the vaccine itself, but also on the process of producing these vaccines, will get these things produced and disseminated much quicker. And regardless of what Bill Gates says, the idea that there aren't manufacturing facilities around the world that can handle this is ridiculous. We just saw a perfect example in this very exotic place known as Pennsylvania. I think it's Philadelphia, where the Johnson & Johnson manufacturing...
Baltimore.
Was it Baltimore?
Yeah.
Well, the even more exotic.
Yeah, I know.
Their facility was garbage. There is, you know, the idea is that the there is this attempt to project this notion that you need to do it in the United States.
India is the number one world producer of vaccines in the world. They've got no facilities up to Bill Gates' standards. Either he's a xenophobic bigot or he has a financial interest in
I don't think that
but maybe a little bit of both.
I don't think he has a financial interest. I think it's ideological. I think it's just purely ideological.
Okay,
I mean,
a controlling God complex interest in it, at the very least.
I think that's a little more accurate, to be honest with you. I mean, people may find it, you know, he may be a little more offended by that, but...
Oh!
But here's the thing. One of the things that Joe Biden promised while he was candidate, Joe Biden, was that if we got into this type of situation, that he would... relax the patent restrictions. Here is a clip of an interview he did back in the, I'm not 100% sure when that was, but it was during the campaign, the general election. Activist Addy Barkin asked candidate Joe Biden if he'd waive IP for a theoretical COVID vaccine. Biden doesn't hesitate.
If the U.S. discovers a vaccine first, will you commit to sharing that technology with other countries? And will you ensure there are no patents to stand in the way of other countries and companies mass-producing those life-saving vaccines?
Absolutely, positively. This is the only humane thing in the world to do.
I mean...
Seems pretty clear there.
Not a lot of wiggle room there. So, you know, disseminate that clip widely.
I mean, what's interesting is that Joe Biden throughout the entire election was talking about how we need to listen to the experts and listen to the scientists. The premier scientists in this area, Dr. Anthony Fauci, or Tony Fauci, as Tucker Carlson would disparage him as, is within the administration encouraging this vaccine waiver, this patent waiver. And Biden seems to not be listening to that particular expert in this area, because there are big pharma executives, at least who are experts in terms of their own finances, who are putting pressure on the other side. But from a purely political perspective, which is clearly the only way you can get through to Democrats at this point, it doesn't look good to side with pharma executives. It certainly does not, even regardless of people's political affiliation, voters.
And the Biden administration has shown that it reacts to blowback on these things. So the more you make us think, the better the chances, to provide these vaccines for the rest of the world. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Aaron Kleinman. He is the director of research for Future Now. We'll be right back, talk about redistricting, and then later, student debt. Meanwhile, today's program sponsored by Magic Spoon. Healthy breakfast does not have to be boring, folks. Magic Spoon has amazing flavors you love, but here's the best part: without all the bad stuff. And look at this. Look at what I have in there. There's some my favorite flavor.
Show what cup that is, though.
Oh, yes.
It's like one of my favorite things I see around the office.
My Jeb 2016 cup. Oh. It has 0 grams of sugar. I mean, a full cup of this has 0 grams of sugar, has 13 to 14 grams of protein, only 4 net grams of carbs in each serving, and only 140 calories per serving. And it has nothing to do with the cup. All that comes from the Magic Spoon cereal that's in there. And exciting news. I knew this in advance because I'm on the VIP phone texting thing.
Okay. And,
yeah, I mean, anybody can get on it. But Magic Spoon has released a super delicious new flavor, birthday cake. I have not tried birthday cake. I'm a cinnamon guy, but I'm going to try it because every time I try a new Magic Spoon flavor, I would say about 66% of the time I find a new one for the kids, and 50% of the time I find one for me. So I love it.
Very nice.
I mean, I'm extremely loyal to the cinnamon, as you can tell by the 8 boxes that I have in the corner of the room. Birthday Cake Magic Spoon will be available in a special 5-pack for a limited time only, so get it while you can. Or you can, of course, build your own box. Available flavors to build your own custom bundle: cocoa, fruity, frosted, peanut butter, and cinnamon. For me, a cocoa, peanut butter, and cinnamon box.
That's nice.
What I'm down for. But if I'm thinking about the kids, I throw in the fruity and the frosted. If you're listening from Canada, guess what, Canada? Magic Spoon now ships there as well. I have Magic Spoon for breakfast, I don't know, 5-6 days a week now. For my kids, it's the only cereal they want, and frankly, it's the only cereal that I want to give them. Go to magicspoon.com/majorityreport to grab a new limited edition birthday cake or a custom bundle of cereal to try it today. And be sure to use our promo code MajorityReport. Use it at checkout. You'll save $5 off your order. This offer is now good anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money. Remember, magicspoon.com/majorityreport. Use the code MajorityReport to save $5 off your purchase. Another product that I have used. In fact, I've mentioned this many times before. That's how we got Brendan. Look, if you're a business owner who's hiring, a lot of challenges right now. Frankly, a lot of challenges at all times. It's difficult. Difficult to find the right person. Difficult to go through the whole process. Maybe you're not finding the right type of applicants. Maybe you can't organize the stuff. I don't know. It's hard. Hiring is hard. Sometimes it feels like you're looking for a needle in a haystack. Indeed. Well, you can post your job to some board. But when you do, all you're doing is hoping that somebody, the right person, you know, answers. And that is a long shot. I remember back in the days when I would post on Craigslist. And believe me, it was like it was lost in the ether. Well, this is why you should try ZipRecruiter. And you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. This is what happens. When you post a job on ZipRecruiter, they send it out to a bunch of sites, like 100 different sites, with one click. Then ZipRecruiter's matching technology finds people with the right skills, the right experience, and they actively invite them to apply for your job. That's what happened with Brendan. They reached out. They found Brendan. In fact, ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter, they get a quality candidate within the first day. I got to be honest. I had like maybe 10 to 12 people that I thought like were all in the running. Brendan showed up and I was like, wow, okay. We'll go with Brendan. He'd already said, did I tell you the story? He had to block me on YouTube because at his last job, he was looking for the clips that we were doing, but he didn't want me in them. I didn't hold that against him. It is no wonder the 2.3 million businesses have come to ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. So while other companies overwhelm you with way too many options, ZipRecruiter finds what you're looking for, the needle in the haystack. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at this web address, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. Once again, remember to go to this unique place, ZipRecruiter.com/majority, M-A-J-O-R-I-T-Y, majority, ZipRecruiter. It is the smartest way to hire. And lastly, speaking of Brendan, I told him that Features was going to advertise on the show. He got about as excited as I've ever seen Brendan get excited.
Did he jump up and down?
I mean, he didn't jump up and down. Brendan doesn't get too excited by anything, really. But he was very psyched. Brendan's a runner. He's like a workouter. I don't know how to say that, but Features has engineered their socks based on the different levels of support and performance your feet need for different activities. And I've never had anybody say to me, like, those are great socks. Have you ever had anybody say to you, like, when you brought a brand? I didn't even know, you know, I hadn't even thought about brands of socks. From a casual stroll with their comfortable everyday crew, which is my go-to now, to high-performance support with Elite Golf Max, Features has your feet covered. Features, spelled F-E-E-T-U-R-E-S, they're obsessed with making better performing socks for everything, from daily wear to active wear. You get targeted compression where your feet need it most for better comfort and support. Plus, you prevent your socks from bunching, slipping, or sliding down in your shoe. And this is the thing. They are designed anatomically for the specific foot. So you can't, you know, you got a left foot and a right foot, and they're labeled. So you can tell which is there, which is also, side note, it's the best way to be able to pair your socks. You know exactly right what you're missing. They have premium materials. Every step you take is cool, dry, and comfortable. And if you're unsatisfied at any point, they'll give you a replacement pair. No questions asked. I have never had a better... I've never had better set of socks. I am almost like now 100% been featurefied. That's my whole thing now. If I find something I like, I just go for it, because I've got socks that I had probably for 6 years that I never even particularly liked, but they have you know, they're cushioned, they're great for walking, they're great for running. Features is so confident you're going to love their socks that they're also offering $10 off your first pair of Features, F-E-E-T-U-R-E-S, when you go to features.com/majority. If these aren't the best socks you've ever worn on or off the golf course or as you're walking or running, they'll take them back. That's features.com/majority. FEETURES.com/majority for $10 off your first pair of Features. All right. Want to welcome back to the program Aaron Kleinman. He is the director of research for Future Now. And Aaron, you here?
I'm here, Sam. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Say hello to Emma.
Hey, Emma.
Hey, Aaron.
You've been such a great addition to the show. So happy to be on while you're here.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Happy to have you on. Yeah. After Sam commanded you say hello to me. Oh, yeah, that's right. New thing.
That's right.
Now, thank you for behaving, Aaron. I appreciate that. That was very appropriate
you
of you. You're getting very your manners are getting excellent. Now, all right. So, Aaron, I got a couple of things I want to talk to you about. I want to look back a little bit on what happened in November a little bit. But first, I want to look forward. You guys have just launched this new a project?
A blog. We're bringing back blogging.
I've never heard of that, blogging.
Yeah.
Down the line, what is that? Is that a reference to the redistricting?
It is, using one of my favorite Jerry Rafferty lyrics to do a blog about redistricting. Redistricting is the most important voting rights issue right now. And it is a process that is run at the state level. So at Future Now, and people can obviously visit the blog at our site, futurenow.org, we know states. And so what we're going to do is we are going to walk people through what's going to happen in all 50 states, what their processes are for redistricting, what people can look for, what the range of potential outcomes would be, and ways that, you know, people might want to get involved as well, because redistricting and gerrymandering in particular really relies on the public being shut out. And so when there are points of leverage for the public to have their voice heard, they really need to use them, because they actually can have an impact down the line, especially if there's litigation, because when maps get litigated, they take evidence from public hearings into account.
All right. This is very important stuff. And I think that states, the Democrats, broadly speaking, the left, broadly speaking, has, I think, got caught flat-footed on the state level. We've probably talked about this in the past. In many respects, Future Now is a response to that. But in 2010, that midterm election ended up having such ripple effects because of what happened in state houses, and the combination of Republicans taking over in many state houses, three chambers, essentially, if you will, or two chambers in the executive, and technology bumping up at that point and being able to sort of like specifically gerrymander in a way. We're seeing the impact of that still dramatically, where we have multiple states. I mean, tell us a couple of the states that are like where you see it the most, because where you have like 55% of the people vote for Democrats in the state, yet the state house has 60% representation of Republicans.
Yeah, I think Wisconsin is the most egregious example. The measure of what you're talking about is proportionality, which is basically whether the makeup of a state legislature is proportional to the vote for the state legislature. And the best way, I think, to measure that is the difference between the statewide outcome and what the outcome was in the median district. And in Wisconsin, the outcome in a median district, that is to get a majority, the 50th district there, because there are 99 districts, was 11 points more Republican than the state as a whole. Biden won the state by about a percentage point. The median state house district there voted for Trump by 10 points. And that's how, so Wisconsin Democrats, if they want to win a majority in the state assembly, would have to win the statewide vote by 11 points more than they did in 2020. That is a far more effective tool at disenfranchising people than any voter ID restriction or anything like that. It's, you know, obviously, making sure that people can actually vote is very important, but, kind of corrupt special interests really rely on gerrymandering to make it so that state legislators don't have to appeal to median voters. They're only appealing to bases, and they're only being funded by, again, you know, if you've seen what happened in Wisconsin the past 10 years, it's because of that legislative map that they were able to do that.
And to be clear, if I know that there's a new voter ID measure in any given state, at least there's an opportunity for me to organize and try and get as many people as I can some type of ID. But once those lines are drawn, it's Johnny Ball.
Exactly. Yeah, it's one of those things where, one of the things that Republicans, their goals are when they pass voting restrictions, even if Democrats can overcome them, they can still force Democrats to spend a lot of resources overcoming them. there's no kind of way for you to just throw money at the problem of unfair lines. And so that's why it's so pernicious. And again, because we're in this, we just had the census, we finally have those numbers out. This is, our once in a decade chance for a lot of places to really affect those lines. There is some litigation that, eventually can change lines mid-decade, but most of the legislative lines that are going to govern this country for the next decade will be drawn in the next year or so.
And that's what just, I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's just what makes the PRO Act so imperative, right? I mean, not the PRO Act, S1, HR1. So can you talk about how that legislation would target some of these dynamics that you're bringing up here?
Absolutely. HR1, I can't speak to the whole thing, but I have looked at the redistricting portions. I would say, there is a way to write HR1 in a way that, first of all, imposes less of a burden on this. It's a little more kind of process focused. And I think one of the most important things that I really hope is maintained throughout it is, they do have a kind of a proportionality, metric there. So they can force states to draw proportional districts. And if they did that at the federal level, I'm still running through scenarios of what would happen. But right now, my estimate is that it would create 15 to 20 more districts that went for Biden than if the process plays out as it would, kind of as expected this cycle. So, I mean, that would be huge at the federal level. And at the state level, HR1 would be amazing because, they do have constitutional authority to require states to draw legislators that have proportional representation. You can't pass federal law saying Wisconsin, you have to draw your state legislative lines in a way that, kind of somewhat reflects the median voter of the state. And another thing is, even if HR1 doesn't advance at the federal level, there are still actions that states can take. In Virginia, for example, when Democrats took over, they actually gave up redistricting power and punted it to a commission. We've seen that in a lot of states where you kind of get out majorities that are kind of focused on narrow special interests. You get in majorities that are focused on the people, and they're willing to give up that power because in a lot of these states, they're not afraid of a fair fight. And I think that, if you have faith in your ideas as a political party, you shouldn't be afraid of a fair fight.
Yeah, well, fat chance on that one. Right. I mean, all right. Well, let's go over and we should be clear here, right? There's the state legislative districts don't always align with the congressional districts, do they? I mean, I know specifically I'm thinking Pennsylvania because they were the congressional districts were fixed by a lawsuit. The state ones weren't. I'm still not 100% clear on what inhibited the state district from being challenged as well. But with all that said, where are the states? And I know you're going to go through all the states and on your blog, and there's a different story in every state in many respects. But where are the ones? Where are the big sort of fires? If I recently divorced Bill Gates and had the ability and contribute to certain areas, like where would be the ones where I would, if I said I want to put out the biggest fires, where would they be?
So Melinda Gates, if you're watching, futurenow.org, we're happy to talk to you about how you can improve lives at the state level. One state I think that will be really critical is one that you mentioned, Pennsylvania. And so the reason why that happened was actually at the legislative level, the Supreme Court appoints the tiebreaker for a commission that draws state legislative lines where the congressional lines are just drawn as a statute. And, so it goes legislature to governor. I think probably some internal politics there, but the Pennsylvania Supreme Court for the first time in three decades during a redistricting cycle is controlled by Democrats. The last two times they had state legislative lines drawn, it was kind of a Republican former judge was appointed as a tiebreaker on the commission. They drew Republican lines. And in Pennsylvania, the state house, the median district is 4 points more Republican than the state as a whole, if Democrats wanted to take back the state house last year, which they tried, they still have had to flip Trump districts, even though Biden won the state. But this time, they actually yesterday appointed former Pitt chancellor, who's a political science professor who knows his stuff. And, you know, the hope is that, you know, Democrats and Republicans, if they want, you know, they can appeal to him by coming to him with a fair map that reflects the state politically. Hopefully he would approve that on the commission. And, you know, the hope is that going into 2022, Pennsylvania Democrats will be able to run on fair lines for the legislature. And you know, even, you know, we look at the 2022 election, we all know that midterm elections tend to favor the party that's out of the White House. But in Pennsylvania, you could have a 4-point shift toward the Democrats just based on the map alone. And so there still might be opportunities there.
And just be clear, when we say a 4-point shift, we're just talking about going back to zero, essentially.
Basically, yeah.
Where it's like just the lines are neutral and they let the voters decide rather than the lines sort of decide which voters they're going to allow to decide.
Yeah. It's, you know, in Pennsylvania, it means that Democrats can, you know, try to orient their platform and their policies toward the electorate of Pennsylvania, not the electorate of Ohio, you know? And that's a really, you know, that's a big distinction and it can make a difference. So Pennsylvania is
anything wrong with Ohio?
Not that there's anything wrong with it, but it's more conservative than Pennsylvania.
What I'm saying in terms of people.
In terms of, no, absolutely not. But you want to make sure that when people are running for office, they're running to appeal to the, you know, really the median of their state.
And Sam, yeah, that was a bit looking into his mind about really Ohio, probably.
Well, I just wanted to make sure that you weren't disparaging Ohioans.
And I love Ohio. And actually, Ohio has a chance for fair districts, too, which is great as well. They actually have the most convoluted process of any state. But even if Republicans can basically try to stall it and try to pass lines on their own, They still have a fairness requirement, and their state Supreme Court seems like it would uphold it. So in Ohio, lines should improve. And again, Ohio was one of the most gerrymandered states coming out of the last census. Their entire congressional delegation, I know we're changing from state legislatures here a bit, their entire congressional delegation has been 12-4 Republican the entire decade. Not a single seat has changed hands.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. So that's Ohio and Pennsylvania. Where else are you guys where else do you guys see the other biggest sort of issues happening or potential?
So Texas is a really interesting one. Republicans have unified control of government there. But there's been a delay in the census results that comes out of Trump's mismanagement and the COVID pandemic, where the states aren't going to get the data that they need to actually draw districts until August or September. So in the Texas Constitution, there are two really important dates. The legislature goes out of session on July 15th, and there's the candidate filing deadlines in December. So that means they would have to try to call a special session. Democrats would have some leverage over what a special session would look like, even though they're not, because there's a 2/3 majority required to really kind of convene one. And so Democrats may actually have some leverage over the Texas map, but that nothing would prohibit Texas Republicans from, you know, having like a court drawn map, say if it comes to that in 2022, if they maintain their legislative majorities in the governorship, they could go back in 2023 and redraw the lines. They did it before in 2003. I'm sure you remember that, the Killer D's in Texas. So again, it just highlights that really, this process takes place at the state level. And, you know, when you're talking about the Texas congressional map, the difference between a court drawn map and a Republican gerrymander might be something like 5 seats for Democrats. So again, like the state of Texas's government is hugely important, not just for people living in Texas, but for people across the country.
And Texas had, the timing of this, I can't necessarily remember when it was, but this became like an issue at the Supreme Court. And actually one of the rulings about racist lines drawn, essentially, it's a rather convoluted result, but it was basically like the Texas legislature drew lines that the Supreme Court found to be racist. Then the next Texas legislature, when it had to adopt new lines, didn't redraw the lines. They just took the lines that were drawn the first time And they were okayed by the Supreme Court because that legislature didn't draw them. So they couldn't have drawn them with racist intent. They just absorbed them.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, I know that sounds nuts to people, but that's why people were screaming about it, essentially. Because it's,
yeah. And, you know, again, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 still should protect lines in some states. But as you saw in that case and many others, it has been eroded over time. Though, you know, again, in 2019, there was still a case where a narrow majority on the court, one that may not exist today, but one then, throughout Virginia state legislative lines for unnecessarily packing black voters. And so, and that might actually have an impact going forward, that case, because it, you know, if you draw a district that it, you know, is more than like 55 or 60% black, that might no longer be constitutional if that can be avoided, because it might be unconstitutionally packed. So that's something to look forward to. And so, and in that case, you know, there might actually be some fruits, like in Alabama, for example. That case might make it so that you actually have to draw a congressional map where there are two majority black districts instead of one. So in Alabama, you might actually get improved lines. So yeah, the courts will play a big role.
What other state? Texas, Pennsylvania. Is there one other state that you're looking at that is going to be key in your mind?
North Carolina is one that I'm kind of looking at with bated breath. They have an early deadline like Texas in December. And they have a Republican legislature, and the governor can't veto it. But they do have a 4-3 Democratic majority on the state Supreme Court. And that state Supreme Court has thrown out partisan gerrymanders before. I think the big question is, how far will, you know, but they are deferential somewhat to the legislature. So to me, the question is, how far will Republicans go? You know, kind of how far will they push the envelope on that? If they push it too far, they risk the state Supreme Court overturning it. And so I think that's a state where, you know, you'd really want to see Democrats united against the map. So, you know, it causes less deference from the court is, you know, that's a big, you know, process point there. It's just making sure that people are united, you know, people are really pushing for a proportional map, because North Carolina is another state. Democrats got 49% of the state House vote. They got 43% of the state House seats. And so I think it's a state where you would hope that, you know, people in the state really become united for a map that reflects the state politically, and the hope that the state Supreme Court would enforce that.
How is your approach changing given the 2020 census? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So the census was actually a big surprise, because you saw three Sun Belt states, Arizona, Texas, and Florida, not gain seats. And you saw some northeastern states, like New York, only lost one seat, and they barely lost it. You know, they were at risk. We were at risk for losing two. And then Rhode Island kept both of its seats. Now, all five of those states have significant Latino populations. But New York and Rhode Island actually invested in outreach to Latino communities for the census. And those three Sunbelt states, which are all run by Republicans, did not. And so that has changed. So, you know, I think people are worried that there may be, especially in Sunbelt states, a Latino undercount. And I don't know to what extent that might be litigated, but that certainly has implications across all districts. You know, because if Latino voters are undercounted, I think at the, you know, certainly at the federal level, you know, it means less clout for really kind of Republican leaning states. Except, you know, Arizona's kind of totally a swing state now, but you know, Florida and Texas still lean somewhat Republican. But it might end, you know, we have to be vigilant for making sure that, you know, line drawers in those states don't, you know, basically pack Latino voters unconstitutionally, especially because they might have been undercounted.
I know the answer to this, but I got to ask, like, what, why in the world would any state, but a Republican state, why would they undercount their own citizens? I mean, is it just like, is it just sheer idiocy mixed with like a tinge of racism, or is it like sheer racism mixed with a tinge of idiocy?
You know, I can't speak to their motive. I mean, I think a lot of them are devoted to an ideological project that's just anti-government at all costs. And it, you know, it leads them to do things that are against their own. I mean, the census doesn't just determine your congressional representation. Trillions of dollars of federal money moves based on census numbers. When you invest in your state and census outreach, you know, that pays for itself.
Yeah.
If you get the people living in your state counted, that means that, you know, that gets paid back. New York did a good job of it, Raleigh did a good job of it, and now they reap the benefits of it. And so, you know, again, you want to elect people at the state level who, you know, will actually, you know, invest in your state. You know, again, spending public money, it's not throwing money. You know, that's the thing that a lot of people don't get. Spending public money isn't money throwing money down the drain. Census outreach literally pays for itself over, like, so many, multiple times. So,
all right. One final question. And I don't, you know, I don't want to put you on the spot, Aaron, but I'm going to put you on the spot. I don't think you've spoken since November. I can't remember. We may have. And if we did, this is the second time I'm putting you on the spot. What happened?
So the good news is you're asking me this, 6 months later when we've had a bit more time to figure out what happened.
Well, that was my plan. Data yet. I mean, you got the data. What happened?
So there are a few things that I think we saw. One is polls continue to, the people responding to them tend to overrepresent people who might vote Democratic. And I think there's a lot of work being done. But because the polls, I mean, you know, the AAPSE and all these other groups, they realize, okay, something went wrong. We're trying to fix it. And, you know, so I've seen a bunch of them trying to figure out, okay, that happened. I think candidates not being able to go door to door on the Democratic side, especially for, at the state legislative level, where, again, you know, if you can knock on 2,000 swing voters' doors, that makes such a huge difference. And we saw that, like, candidates who, you know, went out and door knocked anyway, I mean, some of them really, you know, did better than we might think. And Republicans, candidates really didn't have any compunctions about going door to door. And I think that ended up really harming at the state legislative level as well. COVID, I don't know about you guys, but I think COVID kind of just drove everyone a little crazy. And I think that's kind of hard to capture. I think people got kind of more isolated, more insular. My hope is that, you know, again, we can kind of really kind of be able to reach out to people more, kind of, you know, and again, it's like, you know, we saw so many cases of COVID, you know, someone like, I mean, they're losing their job, having a business shutdown, and then all of a sudden going, you know, spending 20 hours a day on YouTube.
Yeah.
I think that is, might've been a problem as well. And so my, you know, all two of those things are really COVID specific, and, you know, hopefully, you know, I think the polling thing, people are working on it, but and also polls tend to have been better when Trump isn't on the ballot. I think he just brings out a type of person that's hard to reach. It'll be interesting to see. And I think that's the big question looming over politics right now for the next decade. The two things looming over politics over this decade. One, what happens to those Trump voters? And two, what are those lines going to look like? So if you're curious about the second one, futurenow.org, down the line, every week we'll be updating you on kind of what the process is in every state and what you can look for in redistricting.
And what folks can do in terms of, like, you know, pressuring and getting the sense that the lawmakers are being watched.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, because again, in the past, they have really relied on a closed process that people didn't pay attention to, the gerrymandering. Even if, you know, there's no real political leverage in the state, huge Republican trifectas, just shining some light on it, you know, it can really help just, again, building the record against it, maybe in litigation, you know, in the future, and just mobilizing people and letting lawmakers know, hey, this actually is something that matters. This isn't inside baseball. People want a government that represents them.
Aaron Kleinman, Director of Research, Future Now, and with your new blog, what is it? Down the Line.
Down the Line. Your favorite Jerry Rafferty song, everyone. Go to futurenow.org.
I'm the only person who knows what you're talking about. Jerry Rafferty. I'm the only person. Everybody else is younger than that. You're younger than that. I don't know why you're listening to that kind of music anyways.
Yeah, you know, my dad had some old vinyl, you know, he had it lying around the house.
Exactly. That was a song that was a contemporary for
me
when I was a kid.
Don't be shamed into listening to old music. I do it too.
All right, Aaron.
Not doing so.
You're the only person I've ever heard of named a blog after a Jerry Rafferty song. All right. Thanks so much for talking. I appreciate it.
All right. Bye.
Jerry Rafferty song. All right. Well, let's not go anywhere. I want to bring onto the program Astra Taylor and Ume Hoke from the Debt Collective. And Ume is a debt striker, I believe. Welcome, Ume and Astra. Ume, am I saying your name correctly?
It's Ume.
Ume, sorry about that. Okay, welcome to you both. And let's start with you, Astra. You know, we spoke to you, I don't know if it was a couple of months ago, to get a sense of what Biden was going to do or what you were hoping he was going to do over the first 100 days in terms of student debt. Remind everybody just the sheer numbers that we're talking about in terms of debtors and in terms of dollars.
We are talking about 45 million people who have student debt. And in terms of their demographics, they are from all walks of life. So, and it's also important to say that 40% of those debtors don't have degrees. In other words, they have the debt, but they weren't able to finish college for whatever reason. And so they have that hanging over them without the opportunity education supposedly affords you. Growing number of these people are also senior citizens. That's one of the fastest growing categories. People are getting their social security checks garnished because of their student debt. So 45 million debtors, of course, that impacts their families, because if your parent has debt or you're worried about your children, so this actually, you know, compounds and affects a much broader group. And we're talking about $1.8 trillion overall, that we just crossed the $1.8 trillion threshold. That number really sticks out to me because the Debt Collective, some of the founders of the Debt Collective, organized a protest in 2012 that we called One T Day, the day student debt surpassed $1 trillion. And Joe Biden was vice president then. So here he is, president of the United States, and we're looking at the possibility of having to protest Two T Day. So that shows you how fast this problem balloons.
I will say this also, you know, I recently spoke to Ryan Liebenthal, who had written a piece in the New Republic. And one of the things I don't think I fully appreciated was how relatively new this scope of this problem of student debt is, relatively speaking, right? I mean, you say $1.6 trillion, you're like, well, okay, in 45 million people, this must be the culmination of 50 years of debt. This is like, we're only talking, you know, two decades maybe. And this thing, like, I can only imagine where we're going to be, you know, 10 years from now, 5 years from now.
I think that's really important. So the lending program, the foundation of it was put into place in the 60s and 70s, but actually student debt was so minuscule, they didn't even bother tallying it until the 90s. So this is really, really a recent problem. And I want to give you one example of how fast this problem grows. I was spent last night with one of the student debt strikers, Armin Henderson, a doctor. He is only 36. When he got out of medical school 3-4 years ago, after residency, actually, he had $300,000 of student debt for medical school. Now it's $600,000 because of interest. So this is part of why there's this exponential growth. And that's why we need to deal with this problem like now.
I want to put a finer point on that. The Fed did not record student debt until 1999. It was just simply not a factor in our economy. And as of 5 or 6 years ago, the president of Home Builders of America said this was the primary drag on the building of new homes, just as one just sort of data point. So Ume, Hawk, tell us, you are a debt striker. What does that mean? And tell us a little bit about your situation.
Yeah, so I am a debt striker. I'm a proud debt striker. I will not be paying my student loan debt until Joe Biden cancels all of it. And so I currently owe about $77,000 worth of student loan debt from my undergrad and graduate school. But really speaking to what Astra just said as well, when I actually graduated from college, I only owed about $40,000 in debt. So over the past about 7 years or so, it's grown to $77,000. And I just looked at the numbers. If I were to actually pay off this debt in the increments that I'm supposed to, I would end up paying almost $200,000 for my degrees. And it just doesn't seem right. It's definitely not fair. We know that Joe Biden has the authority to cancel all of it. So I'm committed to staying on strike and making sure that he does cancel all of it and that we do develop a pathway to transform our higher education system, because it is such a new problem. Most student loan debt has been accumulated in the past 10 years only. And I am one of those people. And that just does not seem like a way to make so many generations of people live, especially as this becomes a problem for so many different people.
Have you written to Joe Biden? Because I hear from Senator or Majority Leader Schumer that the way to get Joe Biden to act on this is for everybody to write in and write letters about their experience. I mean, to me, this is obviously cover for Joe Biden not acting here. But I mean, I'm joking. There's so many of yous out there, Umi, and it's incredibly discouraging to see that the Biden administration hasn't acted. I mean, do you have optimism, even though it's past his first 100 days, that this will still be seriously considered? Because I thought, you know, this would be the number one thing I'd do. It's so easy, right?
Absolutely. It is so easy. And it's disappointing he hasn't done it yet. But I have written to Joe Biden. I love writing to Joe Biden. I love writing to my state senators and my state representatives, my federal representatives, and I'm happy to do it. And I know that there are lots of people doing that. So even though I am disappointed that it hasn't happened yet, I think that there's been some things that we've seen politically and some conversations that Biden has had, like asking for a memo to see what his legal authority is, that makes me optimistic. And it makes me think that if we have, like, you know, it does feel a bit silly to write to a generic email address, but I'm really happy to call my representative and call my senator too. And it does feel like that political pressure is really working. And we've actually been working to also pass local resolutions calling on Joe Biden to cancel debt. All the different ways that we can get people to call and call on Joe Biden, I think we should do it, because it has only been 100 days. It really is the easiest thing he can do, but sometimes people need to just keep hearing that and to get some more pressure and pushes to do it. And I'm happy to be a part of that song.
What happens now? Okay, for you in particular. All right, so you've decided I'm getting the bills. I'm going to ignore them. They're coming from the U.S. government or someone who is presumably servicing the loan, right? Probably a private corporation servicing the loan. What happens then? In other words, like, you know, how do you discharge this debt? How do you, like, can you go to the court and say I'm bankrupt like everyone else in the country has the ability? Every company has the ability to go in and say I need protection for my creditors. I mean, what happens next?
Well, my debt is all federally held debt, so I cannot go to a court or get it discharged. Our bankruptcy laws are atrocious in this country and really continue to penalize poor people who have taken out student loan debt to be able to achieve the American dream. So that's why I just refuse to pay it. And, you know, our student loan strike is largely symbolic because of the pause on payments. Realistically, the millions of people who are not paying right now are all on strike. And I think that's something that we should all consider is, what if this action that we're all taking is actually a political action? And it's another way for us to really have Joe Biden hear how many people are struggling right now, because the reality is so many of us wouldn't be able to pay this if it wasn't in pause and we'd be on actual strike. But luckily right now we are on pause until September. So that allows that it's kind of a symbolic one. But even after that, if this pause isn't continued or if the loans aren't canceled, I'm going to continue being on strike, because I simply just think that this is immoral and unjust. And our government has the authority and a very simple way of fixing it. And they should, because otherwise we're just going to have more and more generations of people who are struggling in the same sort of way. And what kind of country and society are we building then?
Astra, two questions for you. One, Umi referenced a legal opinion that Joe Biden has asked for, indicating at the very least that publicly there's some awareness that maybe, you know, this is going to come in. First question, when do we anticipate that legal opinion coming in? Second question is, how do we justify doubling Umi's debt over the course of less than a decade when there is, you know, like when people loan money, right? The idea is like, well, we charge this interest rate because there's such a high risk that people aren't going to pay back. She can't discharge this debt. There's no, you know, like she's garnished until till death, essentially. When she gets into Social Security, we just start garnishing her Social Security. So the risk associated with this, it seems to me, is much less. Forget the sort of nauseating notion that our government is making money off of educating our citizens. That just seems absurd. So those two questions, and also let me just one comment, the bankruptcy bill that doesn't allow Umi to discharge this, championed by Joe Biden, just and not a coincidence. But so those two questions, Astra.
Well, I was going to throw in that detail, too, about Joe Biden's legacy. He is, of course, the former senator of Delaware, the credit card capital of the world. We know this, right? When we get the bills, where are they from? Oh, Delaware. That's when you know that you're getting something to do with financial services. So, you know, to be an organizer is always to be of two minds. To one, be relentlessly critical of how you are being screwed over and the way the people in power are falling short. And then to be, you know, disciplined in your optimism, right? That you can keep organizing to push this. So that we're always in that tension in the debt collective. And it's important, I think, to recognize that this is who we're dealing with. Joe Biden has spent his career as a friend of creditors. And so for him to even run on these inadequate promises of canceling some student debt, right, is progress given who he is, who we know he is. The thing is this, thanks to the debt collective's legal research, it is now widely accepted, you know, that the federal government has the authority to cancel student debt using something called compromise and settlement authority. In other words, Congress granted this power to the Secretary of Education in 1965. This isn't the kind of executive authority that's like an overreach, right? Or an act of desperation. This is basically using power Congress already authorized. So basically just doing what has already been determined to be your job, right? So it's also important to note that compromise and settlement authority has been used multiple times in recent years, including by Trump, to cancel interest during this payment pause. Right. So we don't really need a memo. Joe Biden didn't really need to request a memo investigating a legal authority that was just used to cancel hundreds of millions of dollars of debt. So there is a sense in which it feels like it's just stalling and buying time. He could have canceled student debt on day one. What did he do instead? He chose to extend Trump's payment moratorium, right, to extend a failed policy that left out 8 million federal borrowers and also private student loan holders. So that's not something progressives should cheer. You should not cheer a Democratic president continuing a failed Republican policy. Nevertheless, the word on the street is that this memo could be an affirmation of what we know to be true, right? And it could be released in a few weeks. It might take a month or two, but it is coming. I think as organizers, we need to be ready for the worst case scenario, which is that it somehow denies the facts and says that authority that was used recently, oh, actually, we somehow magically don't possess it. Sorry, we can't deliver, right? So that's where we're at. And I think that we have to just keep building power. I think Umi rightly said we're moving to strategies that are not just about individuals being on strike, but arguing that this is something that is for the good of the community. So that's why cities saying, you know, the city of Philadelphia, for example, just passed a resolution. Washington, D.C. is about to pass one. Boston last week passed one saying, we as a city need student debt cancellation to economically recover. It's really important. As for your point about risk, it's just, you know, it shows how erroneous this logic is, right? I mean, it's not just true of the federal government lending and student loans. But right now, you know, lenders across the field have basically insulated themselves from risk, right? That's what the mortgage crisis in 2008 was about. It's like, we get the rewards, we socialize the risk. So if we've made bad bets, we're going to get bailed out, right? And so there's always this idea of moral hazard, like, oh, we can't have bankruptcy protections because debtors will take advantage of them. But what we've done is we've gone in the opposite direction where, you know, lenders can basically play these games with money and they're always, you know, they're always protected at the expense of all of us, because the public comes in and ends up bailing them out. So this logic is just absolutely flawed. I think it's also important to highlight that at the beginning of the COVID pandemic, debtors did get relief, but they just weren't human debtors. They were corporate debtors, right? I mean, we spent billions of dollars stabilizing the corporate bond market, which is the corporate debt market, right? There were also forgivable loans extended to fallen angels. That's the technical term, right? Fallen angels means companies that have suddenly seen their credit score, their rating drop. So why should corporate debtors get relief and not regular people?
Indeed. All right. Well, look, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to ask you about an announcement that was made, I believe, yesterday or maybe yesterday about Rob Corddry and the implications of Rob Corddry's appointment to a position that oversees student debt. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back in just a moment. So Emma and I are back. We're talking to Umi Hawk and to Astra Taylor from the Debt Collective. Umi is debt striker at this point. Of course, payments on student debt have been suspended during COVID, but that'll start back up in September. And really what's happening here is we're trying to send a message to Joe Biden to do what, as Astra tells us, Congress has already authorized him to do, and he's already done in some measure by suspending interest payments. And we also know that even under the Trump administration, this happened under the Obama administration, people who took loans to go to private colleges that universities that did not really provide any type of education, they've had those loans discharged. And it's a similar authority that could operate. So, Umi, I don't know if how in touch you are with about this issue about Rob Corddry being appointed. I don't know if this is a better question for Astra. OK, so Rob Corddry, former head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, close ally of Elizabeth Warren, who has teamed up with Chuck Schumer to call for a $50,000 debt relief. He's been appointed by the Biden administration to oversee student debt. What does that mean? Anything?
I think it bodes really well. I mean, the CFPB was definitely an ally during the Obama administration in fighting some of the abusive debt collection practices that we see from student loan servicers. And also, we were working closely with them around the issue of predatory for-profit colleges who also abuse the lending system. So I think it's a really promising sign. This is somebody who knows about consumer protections. That's, obviously one of Elizabeth Warren's big concerns. And so hopefully we'll rein in some of the most egregious abuses that we see, because essentially the federal government contracts out to these abusive servicers and debt collection companies, giving them millions of dollars in order to extract money that people don't have, right? So that is promising. I believe that he is someone who is open to student debt cancellation, if not for it. I don't want to put words in his mouth. Sadly, he doesn't have that authority at the FSA, right? So that is the ability to compromise and settle, to cancel student debt, is something that is held by the Department of Education, by the Secretary of Education. So it's certainly encouraging news, and it's reflective of this, the mixed emotions we have as we move out of a DeVos era, which was obviously horrendous, into a Biden era where there seem to be a mix of people who recognize how broken and abusive the system is, and some people who honestly played a huge role in developing it since the 90s, as we're saying. So there are people in these departments who literally built the system that now we are saying has to be torn down.
Okay, and Umi Hawk, just in just 5 seconds, where can people join you in your debt strike? Where can they find out more information?
They can find out more information on our website, debtcollective.org.
Okay, all right. You guys hang on for one moment. Emma and I are going to sign off to folks on the Peacock app, and we will be back tomorrow with more. and we are still here.
We're still here.
The magic of so guys, just to continue our conversation, and I appreciate your being quick on that. Did I say Rob Corddry? Rob, I did, I guess.
Well, I mean, it's you, the over under right. for the amount of names Sam's going to mess up in an interview is probably, you know, 3.5.
Right? Yeah, I've hit 2 so far. Yes, so it's Rich Corddry. Apologies. Okay, so Emma, you had a question.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, I'm curious about your guys' perspective on this. As activists who are obviously deeply steeped in this topic, what is the constituency for this kind of hesitancy by Biden, right? I mean, to me, I hear anecdotally some older people say, well, I had to pay for my college and people should have to pay their debt, right? But largely, I don't see this as a voting issue that's going to sway anybody. So have you spoken to people who maybe hold that kind of viewpoint? And if so, does it pale in comparison to, I guess, the amount of people who are on board with this? Because that's my sense of it.
Well, I think it actually is an issue that will really sway people. So, for example, you see Majority Leader Chuck Schumer comparing student debt cancellation to $2,000 checks in Georgia, right? I mean, that was a pivotal concern for voters there. And it's something that, you know, it was a very clear, graspable promise on the campaign trail for the Democrats. And it, you know, will have an immediate beneficial effect on voters. You know, people will really feel it if they get their debt canceled. So, you know, and there's a recent poll from Color of Change that said 40% of Black voters would consider sitting out the election if there's not student debt cancellation. So, you know, I think there's a portion of people in Washington who really see this as a galvanizing issue, right? The kind of thing that will help them hold on during the midterms. I think it would be really suicidal to lift the payment moratorium, not have student deliver any student debt cancellation, and then go into elections and just expect people to keep voting for you. That said, you know, I think your question is a really good one. Who are they appealing to, even if it's less a real constituency and more this idea? And I think you're right. It tends to be older, more affluent people who don't really understand how much has changed since the good old days when they went to college. But I wonder how firmly felt those convictions are. And if you, you know, if you led with the sort of arguments of how much of an economic boost will result from this, the fact that, you know, it would benefit all sorts of industries, right? As you said, home builders, et cetera. The fact that it would allow more people, you know, a kind of to become entrepreneurial, that it would have all of these socially beneficial effects. I just think it's one of these things too, where people, it's, you know, it's overwhelmingly popular, and the people who are against it could be moved. I just want to say that it's overwhelmingly popular, and this is one of those things where you just see how broken our democracy is. I know you guys were talking about redistricting today, right? A majority of people want this, and it's easy to do. There's a clear lever to do it. And the fact that it's not happening just shows you how captured and undemocratic our political system is.
I think you were onto it with Joe Biden, you know, a former senator from MBNA, the sanctity in which, you know, and this is not, too dissimilar from his name escapes me now. During the Obama era, Secretary of Treasury saying, you know, we don't want to add to the moral hazard. You know, we don't want people to understand that, like, sometimes your debt's forgiven. We can only teach that to corporations. But just getting to your point in terms of like the old folk not appreciating how things have changed. This is from that Liebenthal article 40 years ago. And I read this in it, and it was pretty revelatory for me for two reasons. 40 years ago, a year of tuition and fees at a public four-year university was around $2,400. That's in 2019 dollars. $2,400. Now the cost is four times as much. For private colleges, that number has tripled from nearly $11,000 in 1980-81 to nearly $32,000 by 2019. And I was like, well, you know, 40 years ago, that's a long time ago. And then I realized, like, hey, wait a second. Actually, no, I was probably around the time applying to colleges 40 years ago. So, I mean, you know, give or take a couple of years. And so this isn't that long ago. And to have it, triple in this fashion. So let me ask you this, Umi. Do you How much of an opportunity have you had to express this to some of us elders about the, you know, how things have changed so dramatically?
I think, I mean, the opportunity to really engage on that and talk to lots of people on it, I think, is one of the key aspects of the organizing we're trying to do, to really highlight and show how, as Astrid was just saying, this is a really popular issue. It's something that is a voting issue, but it's also something that's so important to our communities and all the impacts that it could have, and really finding any forum to have that conversation. But also because, as we keep seeing, like, the gap of the growth of people who actually are in that older age bracket who have student loan debt, especially if they're like co-signing on their parents, on their kids' loans and things like that, that number is growing as well. And so we're actually seeing in some of our organizing that we're doing that there are a lot of older people who are showing up to have those conversations as well, and actually having to and actually able to support other people understanding, like, this, the education as an industry or as a market or however it might be conceptualized has so dramatically changed, and in such a short period of time, that it's almost unfathomable. And it's probably why these numbers are unfathomable. 1.8 billion is such a large amount of money, but being able to really specifically speak to what that would mean for our communities and where we're living seems to really have an impact, especially during a pandemic when so many people are losing their jobs and their healthcare. And it's really clear that families are struggling. It's just a way for all of us to be able to really achieve something together. And I think that's why us really shifting our organizing from, like, getting these resolutions passed or working in our institutions and getting other people to call together to say, this isn't just about the debt that I, Umi Hawk, hold as from my graduate school. It's actually about all of the debt that our entire society and community holds, and the fact that we need to change it together. And that's going to take everyone of all age brackets and demographics to achieve that.
I do want to, you know, it's interesting. We often portray debt as a millennial issue or a Generation Z issue. And it really is. We can't, you know, exaggerate this. It's a crisis for older people. What happens after a crisis like 2008, 2020, people lose their job? They go back to school to get training so that they're hireable, right? Because we have a society where you have no security. Right. And so what we saw after 2008 was a bunch of older people getting degrees and then taking on that student debt. We're seeing the same thing now. And that is part of what is causing this rapid growth of indebtedness among older folks who should be able to, who should be planning for retirement, right? Not trying to reinvent themselves. And I think that's really critical. There was also just a report on the fact that for older people during this pandemic, their non-mortgage debt has significantly risen, right? So this is also just a crisis that connects to our ability, you know, to ever rest, to ever retire. And how does this then compound as generations go on?
And we should say that dynamic of returning to school, particularly after the financial crisis, is what drove a lot of the for-profit colleges, particularly with Black women. And so there is a disproportionate amount of that debt held by, non-millennial Black women because of that dynamic. And that is a broader function of racism, in a sense, that there is a ceiling there and you need to get that extra degree to move forward. Umi, let me just ask you this, like, to what extent has the debt impacted your conception of your own career going forward? Like, has it inhibited choices for you?
Of course. Yeah, absolutely. And every person who's on debt strike talks about how it's impacted choices. I feel like debt impacts every aspect of life, even unconsciously, like where you choose to move or where you choose to live. It's helped me decide what career path to take. And I live in rural New Mexico now because it's cheaper here. Like, it's just every single part of that. We have folks who are on strike or members of our union who are talking about how they don't have kids because they can't afford it or they can't buy a home. There's just everything that's so practical and tangible, being able to be creative and live the life that you wanted to live or do the job that you wanted to do. It forces you into decisions about every single aspect. And that's the sort of thing that we could actually completely transformed by canceling this debt, which would allow people to take on careers that they wanted or do different things with their lives or buy that home they've always wanted to buy or have that kid. And as we're in a global pandemic and in a crisis where we're worried about what jobs people are doing and we're worried about, you know, growth rates around the country and talking about things like the census and populations, like, there is so much there that we could actually achieve if we were to cancel this debt. There's just an open, expansive world of possibilities of the life I didn't lead and 45 million people didn't leave because they had debt.
Umi Huck, Astra Taylor, thank you so much for your time today. Astra, we're going to have you back for your book, which I know is coming out, and I can't remember the name of the book that's coming. Remind me.
Remake the World.
Remake the World.
Remake the World. Thank you.
I had to hit my third. I had to hit my third. I had to hit my third quotient that's not really a name, but it's an title. So
it's a flub.
Yeah, it's a flub.
That's awesome. I would love that. That would be great.
Great. Good luck to both of you. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us on.
Thanks.
All right, folks, we're going to head into the fun half of the program. Went a little long. I got a lot of IMs to get to about how I said Rob Corddry as opposed to Richard Corddry. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's why we call it the fun half.
It's just meant to, like, inspire your imagination a little bit.
You know, sometimes what I like to do is...
Because Rob Corddry's an actor.
Rob Corddry's a comedic actor. Right. Yeah, no. And
The guy. Yeah, I know this guy.
Right,
yeah,
of course you do.
Great
of course
guy.
You do. And Richard Corddry, former governor of Ohio, former head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Look, a lot of times I want to just check, make sure people are listening, and you guys passed. You guys passed the quiz today. So good for you. I'm going to note that down, actually. I'm going to write a little note of that. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes the show possible. If you go to jointhemajorityreport.com, you not only support the free show, you get the free show free of commercials, and you get the fun half. And I will also say this, that if we get 100 new members over the next week, I will take some type of Learning Annex class on how to pronounce names.
Oh, you.
And we need to get 100 new members within the next.
Just throwing good money after bad, I think.
Yeah.
Lying to the audience.
I'm not lying. If we get 100 new members, I will do that.
Okay.
If I can find one,
mm-hmm.
if I can find a Learning Annex class that teaches that, I would do it.
You know?
I mean.
Our audience believes that you're operating.
I swear to God, I will do it. 100 new members. And if I can find one.
So, like, elocution?
Not elocution. It's...
Yeah, there is an elocution center in Borum Hill that also teaches languages.
Yeah, okay.
I think it's more of, like, a pronunciation, like, Learning Annex class. Not elocution.
So you want, a speech therapist, then?
Well, I don't... Let's not get carried away. I mean...
You're the one who threw it out there.
I don't know. Send me... I'll tell you what. We get 100 members and folks will send me suggestions.
You don't get to...
So Sam asks for help.
Yeah, right. I mean, you don't get to set a figure and then, not have a clear promise. That's not how it goes here.
What? Of course. That's almost operating... That's SOP around here.
100 members for something.
Yeah.
I'll determine it later.
That sounds good.
Cool.
That sounds good.
Seems like it serves one of us.
Check out the AM Quacky at amquickie.com. 6-7 minutes every morning in your podcast server. And of headlines, also justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off.
If we get 1,000 members, will you get... electric shock therapy?
Low grade. If we get 1,000 members in the next 2 days, I will do low grade electro. They actually have, I'm not going to say his name, but there was a comedian who came through Boston. This is now 30 years ago, probably, when we were doing cross comedy. A lot of fairly well known comedians would come through. And we would all hang out. They really liked what was going on with cross comedy. And this guy came through. And you know, comedians, as a generalization, at least back then, I don't know about today, would often have had different substance abuse problems.
Okay.
And this guy had had some substance abuse problems. And the way that he got off it, he said, was... he had a set of electrodes that he would, he was traveling with.
Oh.
And he would hook himself up for I don't know how long and just give himself like jolts of electricity, and it would juice the endorphins, and that was it. So, yeah, I'll do the low grade thing for a thousand.
I mean, you can do the like, you go to the, I think they still allow that. You go to the hospital and you get like,
isn't that what Pac-Man does? He does like, he'll, that's how he drives his membership and his subscriptions on YouTube, is he promises like electro.
Different medical procedures, and he'll film it behind the paywall, though.
Matt, are you, did you leave or are you still here?
My internet just dropped, my brand new fiber internet, but I'm here now.
Whoa, look Hi. At that. God, camera. What kind of camera are you using? It looks really good.
This is the Logitech Brio 4K.
Whoa, sweet.
Hey,
all right.
Hat.
Thank you. Yes, I just, this is my brand new Baltimore Orioles hat. Yeah, people who follow my Twitter feed will know that my cousin recently got his first major league appearance against the Yankees. Jay Flaw is his name. And he struck out Aaron Judge and also got Giancarlo Stanton to ground into a double play.
So nice.
Yeah.
Aaron Judge.
That was after walking two guys, so he kind of had to bail himself out. But, you know.
I like how your mic is also picking you up from there. That sounds pretty good.
Oh, yeah, good. I was glad. I was wondering how it was reaching you.
Hi.
Yeah. What is happening? I mean, we can see. I mean, this is like you got all that super duper. You've upgraded all your equipment now. What's happening with in the Matt Leckian media universe?
Yeah, on Thursday, Left Reckoning 8 Eastern, Luke Savage of Jacobin will be joining us to talk about Big Pharma and how they aren't good guys, even though everyone's sort of touting which vaccine they have, like it's their new sports team. And also Bill Gates will be doing a lot of Bill Gates dunking specifically. So that's 8 Eastern, patreon.com/leftreckoning to get the post game.
I hope you're not going to bring up the divorce.
Oh, probably, yeah. And how, yeah, I think I would have divorced Bill Gates as well.
Yeah, that their relationship breaking up could have like implications for public anything health. Beyond like their kids. And
I just saw a tweet from some guy who said he's a like a sort of resistance style Democrat that said, wouldn't it be amazing if Melinda, or what's Bezos's a former
Mackenzie. Wife?
Mackenzie Bezos and Melinda Gates teamed up and solved climate change. And I think that would be great. I think it'd be also unlikely. You know.
You know what? Like, I don't want them to team up to solve anything. You know what would be great is if they teamed up and advocated for a wealth tax.
That confiscatory taxation.
That took away most of their wealth. And that would be great.
That would be awesome. Like, that'd be the ultimate, like, getting back at these asshole husbands. Like, these guys should not have this amount of economic decision making.
Right. Without a doubt. And it's not just economic. I mean, like...
Right.
Look at the people who are dying, you know, over 3,000 a day now in India. It is like, this is, you can't draw necessarily I don't know if you can draw a direct line to Bill Gates, but the line doesn't really take many detours. I mean,
we had Milton Alamalli talking about Walter Rodney, who famously wrote a book, The Underdevelopment of Africa by Europe, or how Europe developed underdeveloped Africa. So this whole thing about they don't even have capacity to produce vaccines. One, if that wasn't a lie, which we know it is, it would say like, why don't they have capacity to build this? It's probably because of what our monopolies have been doing to them.
Yeah. Well, they, you know, it is very difficult to believe in 2021 that countries in Africa could have a factory with some like requirements of keeping things hygienic, like, you know,
yeah, wow. That wasn't blown up by Bill Clinton.
Good point.
They should start like some sort of foundation, you know, to make a difference of like getting more women as CEOs of defense manufacturers.
That would be nice. David Feldman had a funny joke about that, like literally 25, 30 years ago, where he, and I think I've mentioned it to him. You know, he said something to the effect of like, we need more women as leaders of the countries, because women don't start wars, except for Indira Gandhi and Bhutto and Margaret Thatcher. And then he just listed
Well, it's just the dumbest shit ever, because like, if more women were in power, women would just start wars.
I mean, I think it would be a good thing for more women to be in power, but it wouldn't be
It's not correlation equals causation. It's because women haven't been in power, so they haven't been able to historically start the most amount of
wars. The ones who have been have.
And they have, yeah.
Folks, see you in the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. Are you guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.